had been shelved. Rommel was also refused a request for more anti-tank guns. On 21 August, he suffered a fainting fit, only fully recovering when he was assured that Hitler was not about to replace him with General Guderian. Increasingly aware that time was running out, at the end of August, Rommel made a final attempt to crack the El Alamein line, this time in its central sector at Alam Halfa. His own forces' lack of fuel and again the superior intelligence of the British thwarted his advance. Indeed, when the Afrika Korps tried to launch one of its tried and tested night attacks, its forces were caught in the glare of British flares, as, in Rommel's words, the whole valley, with the mass of the Afrika Korps stationary, was lit up like a huge orange fairyland. Montgomery pinned his armour to the ridge and let his air support pound the German advance. Rommel's further enforced quiet after Alam Halfa enabled Montgomery to continue rebuilding the Eighth Army and strengthening its morale. On 30 September, Montgomery was promoted to Field Marshal. October saw the Luftwaffe's last ever assault on Malta. When that too failed, the supply balance tipped away from Panzer Army Africa irrevocably. Not only the quantity, but also the quality of Allied equipment now threatened to overwhelm the Axis. The U.S.-manufactured Grant and Sherman tanks were a significant improvement on previous British tank designs. The Grant could outgun any panzer, bar a Mark IV with a 75mm cannon. The Sherman, despite a tendency to catch fire easily, the Germans came to call them Tommy cookers, was even more formidable because it was armed with a 75mm gun in its turret. British artillery benefited from the, albeit gradual, introduction of the 6-pounder and the 7.2-inch howitzer. In addition to this, and its now emphatic air supremacy, the Eighth Army gained an inflow of reinforcements. Montgomery also introduced changes to the Eighth Army's organization and tactics. German practice was still not matched in either respect, but at least the gap narrowed. He organized his corps flexibly so that their composition could be changed according to the developing situation. Signals establishments were expanded and better quality radios used. This particularly benefited the accuracy of British artillery. Subordinate commanders were now required to have forward tactical HQs, as the Germans did, and now that the Axis forces were on the defensive, the task of commanding from the front was less dangerous than before. By now, moreover, British Army training was benefiting from improved exercises, tactical battle drills, and an innovative system of battle inoculation that prepared the troops for the sights and sounds of actual combat. Overall, the Eighth Army began to approach a standard similar to that of the Afrika Korps, as a force whose armour operated as part of a combined arms plan rather than hurtling in on its own. And the Eighth Army was now a great deal better resourced than the Afrika Korps had ever been. The Second Battle of El Alamein, which heralded Montgomery's intended decisive offensive against Panzer Army Africa, commenced on 23 October. By then, Rommel was back in Germany on recuperative leave, and Panzer Army Africa was commanded by General of Panzer Troops Georg Stummer. Although its tank force had been built up again, Stummer still commanded only half the tanks of the Eighth Army. Panzer Army Africa comprised around 60,000 combat troops against Montgomery's 195,000. The disparity in air strength was even greater. On the other hand, Rommel had lain nearly 500,000 mines, and his infantry held numerous formidable strong points. The battle commenced with an 892-gun artillery barrage and an air attack. Stummer had failed to bombard the British forward areas beforehand in an effort to save ammunition. He then died of heart failure while on reconnaissance, and a still only half-recovered Rommel was brought back to Egypt on 25 October. Tellingly, Panzer Army Africa was now renamed the German-Italian Panzer Army, as though this would share out the blame more explicitly for the fate that was about to befall it. Montgomery envisaged not only a fancy set of offensive manoeuvres, but an organised set-piece battle that would marshal the Eighth Army's superior numbers and materiel to full effect. The first stage of his planned offensive was the break-in, codenamed Operation Lightfoot, in which his infantry penetrated the Axis minefields to clear them for his armour. Once the armour went in, the Afrika Korps' 88s again inflicted heavy losses upon it. But this was an attritional First World War battle, fought with Second World War weaponry, and the outnumbered forces of the German-Italian Panzer Army could not compete for long. "The situation continues very grave," Rommel wrote to his wife on 29 October. "By the time this letter arrives, it will no doubt have been decided whether we can hold on or not. I haven't much hope left." Such was the rate of destruction within the 21st Panzer Division, for instance, that by 4 November it had only 20 operational tanks left. An after-action report by the 15th Panzer Division described what Rommel's armor was now up against. "There is no German weapon in Africa that can destroy the new American tank from a distance of over 2,000 meters, 2,200 yards. It also observed that the British were fitting both new and old tanks with 7.5-centimeter guns. With this, they are reaching a range which is 1,000 meters, 1,100 yards, further than the average firing range of all German anti-tank weapons. General result, the tanks and anti-tank weapons the German army uses in Africa are no longer the best in the world." Although the Eighth Army did not immediately break through, it formed a new salient, and the German-Italian Panzer Army was damned however it tried to respond. If it failed to counterattack, then the Eighth Army would break out of the salient. In the event, the counterattacks the Panzer Army did launch ground down its own strength even further. On 1 November, the Eighth Army commenced its own breakout, codenamed Operation Supercharge. The Axis forces were deceived by a feint assault in the south, but the real blow came further north between the Germans and Italians. On 2 November, Rommel began pulling part of his force out of the line. The following day, he wrote to his wife, "We seem to be crushed by the enemy weight. I've made an attempt to salvage part of the army. I wonder if it will succeed. At night I lie open-eyed, racking my brains for a way out of this plight for my poor troops." That same day, Hitler refused Rommel's request to withdraw, decreeing, "You can show your troops no other road but that to victory or death." Here, for the first time, Hitler was applying a central dictum of National Socialist warfare, that the will to stand fast could best any material odds, in a manner that would have doomed an entire army to destruction. It was the beginning of Rommel's disillusionment with his Führer. Retreat would soon become even more urgent with the news that another Allied army, predominantly comprising U.S. troops, had landed to the west on the coast of French North Africa. Eventually, Kesselring backed Rommel's request to retreat. Hitler finally granted it, while raging that Rommel had lost his nerve. Taking advantage of a timely rainstorm and of the Italian trucks they had purloined, Rommel's German troops were able to escape. They managed to retreat in an orderly fashion thanks to a good order of march and Montgomery's reluctance to pursue them more energetically, still less to try to encircle them. There followed successive battles between November and January in which the Germans performed a temporary holding action, usually lasting about a day, before withdrawing again. They reallocated their fuel to where it was most needed. This gave them just enough strength to launch last-minute local counterattacks to delay the Eighth Army's pursuit. Rommel also used his limited reconnaissance effectively to observe the enemy's main point of effort. He attributed Montgomery's failure to inflict a more decisive defeat to an overly methodical attitude and a mania for building reserves, but this was only a partial and simplistic version of the true picture. British Army Command remained more hierarchical and bureaucratic than its German counterpart. This system might improve an army's day-to-day running, but did not aid swift decision-making in battle. But Montgomery was also cautious because he was conscious of the limited manpower and resources Britain was able to devote to her army. In comparison with the resources directed towards the Royal Navy and Royal Air Force, the army was Britain's third service over the course of the war as a whole. Even so, Montgomery's defeat of Rommel at El Alamein had been emphatic. All that now remained for the Germans in North Africa was another 6 months of tenacious but irreversible fighting retreat before a final stand in Tunisia in May 1943. The fight between the Axis and the British-led forces in the desert has been almost universally depicted as a war without hate, lacking any of the brutality of the Eastern Front. Broadly speaking, this is true. For one thing, there is no evidence that Rommel treated Allied POWs anything other than correctly. Among other things, as well as the sparing of the French Foreign Legion troops at Bir Hakeim in June 1942, Rommel apparently tore up a general order to execute captured British commandos when it was transmitted to him in October 1942. But there are important caveats to the idea of the campaign's relatively chivalrous nature. There was at least one straightforward reason why it lacked the ideologically driven brutality of the Eastern Front. There were virtually no civilians to aid either side and risk reprisals as a result. The only exception was the nomadic Arabs who travelled the region. These had little, if any, personal interest in the campaign's outcome, and it was relatively easy for them and the combatants to avoid one another. Yet when Rommel did show concern about the Arabs, he also showed insight and restraint. In the spring of 1941, he reported how, as a result of Italian loss of prestige after Graziani's defeat, a number of Arab tribes had begun to get restive. This was not helped by the fact that Italian troops occasionally took liberties with the Arab women, a thing which Arabs particularly resent. I was forced to send an urgent request to the Italian High Command, asking them to see to it that the Arabs were treated with sufficient respect to avoid an armed uprising close behind our front. At about this time, officers and men of the Trento Division were responsible for several excesses against the Arab population, with the result that the Arabs killed a number of Italian soldiers and kept the Italians away from their villages by armed force. There are always people who invariably demand reprisals in this sort of situation, for reasons, apart from anything else, of expediency. Such action is never expedient. The right thing to do is to ignore the incidents unless the real culprits can be traced. It would be interesting to see how Rommel would have responded to resistance from Slavic subhumans, but this quotation suggests a general whose view of irregular warfare would also have marked him out as a moderate, relatively speaking at least, on the Eastern Front. The Desert Campaign was not entirely detached from the criminality of the Third Reich's wider war. Had the Axis overrun Egypt, still more gone into the Middle East, there would have been nothing clean about this victory, for it would eventually have spelt the destruction of the region's Jewish population. An Einsatzkommando under Obersturmbannführer Walter Rauf was waiting to follow in the wake of Panzer Army Africa, and in the event of a complete Axis victory over the Eighth Army, it would have rounded up Egyptian and Middle Eastern Jews to face the same fate as their fellows across Germany and occupied Europe. A reminder of what prejudices lurked beneath the surface of the Wehrmacht forces serving in North Africa came in Tripoli at the beginning of 1942. At this point, as the final solution began gearing up across German-occupied Europe, Wehrmacht personnel were appalled that the Italian administration in the port was protecting the city's approximately 16,000 Jewish inhabitants. Anti-Semitic measures were certainly carried out in Axis-occupied Tunisia during late 1942, when Rauf's Einsatzkommando forced Jews to build fortifications. At this time, however, Rommel's forces were retreating from Egypt, and there is no evidence that Rommel himself had contact with the Einsatzkommando. None of this is to deny that Rommel sympathized with many tenets of Nazi ideology, admired Hitler greatly for a long period, and flagrantly exploited his own party connections in the service of his career. And as his tenure as commander of Army Group B in northern Italy during the summer and autumn of 1943 would demonstrate, his conduct towards occupied civilians was not always blemish-free. It seems, however, that Rommel's reputation has been tarnished to an unfair extent by some scholars of recent decades. Such scholars, while understandably seeking to negate the reverence that some of Rommel's early biographers heaped upon him, may have thrown out the baby with the hagiographical bathwater. The justifiably measured view of Rommel's military performance is that, though he could be impetuous and disorganized, his grasp of Auftragstaktik was sound on balance. He certainly proved a superior tactician compared with the majority of opponents he faced in North Africa during 1941 and 1942. His troops might not love him, but they respected him because he gave them victories. If his strategic ambitions in June 1942 were overinflated, he could be forgiven for some overconfidence considering the performance of his British opponents until then. He was also pushed into invading Egypt, if for the greater part willingly, by the Nazi leadership. Rommel's achievements were particularly impressive considering his logistical difficulties, difficulties of which he was more cognizant than he is sometimes given credit for being. He also retreated skillfully, even though this also had something to do with Montgomery making it easier for him. Yet there was a limit to how long Allied commanders would go on repeating the same tactical blunders as their predecessors, especially considering the rapidity with which the British in particular replaced their failing commanders. There was also a limit to how long the Allies' technical proficiency would continue to lag behind that of the Germans. The timescale was even more truncated because of the Allies' burgeoning resources and Rommel's growing dearth of them throughout the course of 1942. The Axis forces in North Africa had always been severely stretched, but this did not stop them from winning. The tipping point came when their opponents became not only better resourced, but also more competent. The one fed into the other. For instance, when the British received better quality tanks, they could develop armoured tactics that consisted of more than just hurling their armour at the German line in the flimsy hope of breaking through before it was destroyed. Over time, moreover, intelligence and air power told increasingly in favour of the Eighth Army and against the Axis. The Germans' initial victories were due not just to Rommel's leadership, but also to the Afrika Korps' wider qualities. Its main strengths lay less in its weaponry than in its tactics, its superior combined arms organisation, the effectiveness of its tactical level intelligence, the training of its officers and men, and the speed with which they adapted to harsh North African conditions. There are echoes here not just of the efficiency and audacity of the German army's performance in its early campaigns, but also in how its troops adapted, however painfully, to the environment of the Soviet Union. Unfortunately for the German army, by late 1942 these qualities were no longer enough to enable it to wrest back the initiative from an enemy that was not only better resourced, but also increasingly capable. This was now as true of the German army fighting in North Africa as it was of the much larger German army fighting in the Soviet Union. Chapter 13. Southern Russia and Stalingrad, 1942-1943. Between December 1941 and April 1942, the German army held the line of the Eastern Front against Red Army counterattacks for 4 months. From then until the autumn it recovered sufficiently to at least try, together with the Luftwaffe, to wrest back the initiative on the Eastern Front. Thus would it make a last major effort to shift the entire war's strategic balance back in Germany's favour. An ambitious new offensive in the south attempted to capture the entire industrial and mining region of the Donbass, the oil of the Caucasus, and the city of Stalingrad. The offensive certainly showed what the German army was still capable of, but also further exposed the weaknesses that increasingly debilitated it. Ultimately, it also failed, and with catastrophic results. Essentially, Hitler and the Germans tried to go for everything and were left with nothing. Such were the losses the Army and Luftwaffe had suffered during 1941 that a renewed offensive along the whole Eastern Front was out of the question. Among other things, the Germans had lost over 300,000 men killed, twice as many as during the war's first 20 months. By the start of March 1942, German forces in the East had fallen from a total of 3 million men at the beginning of July 1941 to slightly more than 2.5 million, and only 8 of the Army's 162 divisions were considered fully capable. An immense amount of refreshing and rebuilding was needed then before the Germans could launch even a more targeted offensive. Yet after the failure in the East in 1941 and the entry of the United States into the war, Hitler was convinced that attack the Germans must. To do anything else would further hand the initiative to Germany's enemies. On 5 April 1942, Hitler issued a directive through the OKW proclaiming Germany's main offensive effort in the Soviet Union during 1942. It would focus on the South and would be codenamed Operation Blue. The offensive was intended to destroy the remaining military forces of the Soviets once and for all, and, as far as possible, remove from them the most important economic resources necessary for the war effort. In the German southern path lay the heart of the industrial and mining region of the Donbass, and beyond that, the oil of the Caucasus. Capturing the Caucasus would also provide Germany with gold, manganese, and other materials, open up the Middle East, and in doing so, sever lend-lease aid routes that the Western Allies had opened up to the Soviet Union. There were even notions of closing in on the Middle East in a pincer movement with Rommel. Above all, Hitler believed that capturing the Donbass and the Caucasus were essential to Germany's war effort against the potentially overwhelming economic strength of the newly aggrandized Allied coalition. "If I don't get the oil of Maikop and Grozny," he remarked on 8 May, "then I must end this war." He believed that if the Germans could not only capture such rich economic prizes, but also compel the Red Army to burn up its remaining strength defending them, they would both finish off the Soviet Union and position themselves far better against the Western Allies. Meanwhile, the Germans would counter any threat from the West with their U-boat campaign against shipping in the Atlantic, while Germany's new Japanese allies would help by keeping the Americans busy in the Pacific. In reality, even if the German offensive had captured all its objectives and destroyed much of the Red Army in the process, the war against the Soviet Union would not have been over. Furthermore, the economic might of the new Allied coalition, particularly that of the United States, would at best have been immensely difficult for the Germans to overcome, even with the entire resources of occupied Europe and the Soviet Union at their disposal. Nevertheless, a successful German offensive in the southern Soviet Union would have had tangible effects. At the very least, it would have delayed Germany's defeat considerably. Furthermore, after his temporary despondency of late 1941, Hitler felt anything but pessimistic about Germany's long-term outlook by April 1942. The Germans were holding the line in the east, advancing in North Africa, and enjoying immense success against Allied shipping in the Atlantic. Meanwhile, the Japanese appeared to be running rampant against the Allies in the Far East and Pacific. But German efforts to prepare sufficient forces for Operation Blue gave serious cause for concern. One of the greatest worries was the quality of available new manpower. Germany's European allies and satellites would make a sizable, if uneven and unreliable, manpower contribution to Germany's war effort in the East during 1942. In addition to Finnish forces operating alongside the Germans at the northern end of the Eastern Front, the Italian 8th Army, Hungarian 2nd Army, and Romanian 3rd and 4th Armies would join Army Group South for Operation Blue itself. Among the new formations raised for the German forces during 1942 were the Luftwaffe field divisions. These were a consequence of Göring's desire for a bigger piece of the action in the land war. They comprised retrained former Luftwaffe ground personnel, and though they were well equipped, they had received training nothing like as rigorous as the armies, and would prove far less formidable in frontline combat than in anti-partisan warfare. Hermann Balk, who in May was appointed commander of the 11th Panzer Division in the Army Group Center Sector, called the Luftwaffe troops good and willing people, but absolute military novices. During any action, they did not even have the capability to maintain their supply of rations and ammunition. Of greater quality, its ongoing teething troubles notwithstanding, was the steadily expanding Waffen-SS, whose total personnel numbered 170,000 by December 1941, compared with 50,000 a year earlier. Though a number of individual army commanders increasingly valued the fighting power of the SS, the army leadership as a whole regarded it with mounting concern as a rival organization that increasingly challenged the army's previous monopoly on arms. Hitler pointedly and entirely unfairly singled out Waffen-SS units for particular praise after the winter of 1941 to 1942. In contrast to today's Wehrmacht, it has stood the harshest test in the autumn and winter through its particular spiritual focus and solidarity. This was a deliberate ploy, for like a teacher singling out a pet pupil, Hitler was promoting the Waffen-SS as an ideological example for the army to follow. By the spring of 1942, the Waffen-SS counted 6 divisions, most of which were motorized along lines broadly similar to their army counterparts, and also receiving their own panzer battalions. The great majority of replacements still went to the army. It accepted a growing number of foreign volunteers from across Europe, such as the Spanish Blue Division and the Legionnaire divisions from Croatia. Though they were fervently anti-communist, their combat value varied. but by far the largest source of new army manpower still came from Germany itself. On 10 January 1942, Hitler had issued a new decree that reprioritized the manpower needs of the army over those of the other service branches and of German industry. But the main injection of new German manpower into the army was the class of 1923. This had been called up in April 1941, 18 months ahead of schedule, and would comprise a considerable part of Operation Blue's manpower. Yet the front's desperate manpower needs meant that these new recruits were trained less extensively or thoroughly than their older comrades. From 1940 onwards, moreover, recruits found their 3 months of basic training spread out because they had to mix it with sentry duty and work on bringing in the harvest. To compensate for all this, Army Group South divisions sought to implement rigorous training programs to prepare their men for the change from defensive back to offensive warfare. Yet there was a limit to what such efforts could achieve, particularly among newly formed divisions. One OKH representative who visited the front in April 1942 declared that the worth in training and inner bearing of these new formations is described on all sides as exceedingly bad. OKH planners sought to circumvent the problem by creating 3 new classes of division. Of the 156 German divisions in the east, only 40 received first order classification. These would be fully replenished and re-equipped for offensive action. 54 were designated second order divisions. Within these, 1 regiment or 3 battalions were to be dissolved, its manpower distributed across the division to fill the gaps. Finally, 62 stationary divisions were to be equipped specifically for defense. Transfers from other army groups and from the occupied West gave Army Group South a total of 71 German divisions. Along with the Allied and satellite divisions, it numbered more than 90. Equipping Army Group South's German divisions was another matter. The German war economy would undergo a rather lean year in 1942. In 1941, Fritz Todt, the armaments minister, had been authorized by Hitler to initiate rationalization measures enabling firms to optimize their use of machinery and available workers. Todt died in a plane crash in March 1942, but his successor, Albert Speer, continued the work of centralizing and rationalizing the German armaments industry. Speer's measures benefited from his predecessor's groundwork more than Speer would later admit, and his efforts would also gain from a massive influx of foreign labor, including slave labor from across occupied Europe. But output levels would not start showing the full effects until 1943. By contrast, Soviet levels of armament production outperformed Germany's in every important area during 1942. By 2-1 in combat aircraft, 3-1 in small arms and artillery, and 4-1 in tanks. In part, the Soviets were able to achieve such feats even before supplies of equipment and other material aid from the Western Allies really began making an impact because of their utter ruthlessness. They extensively used labor camp inmates and diverted agricultural workers into industry at a cost of condemning hundreds of thousands to starvation. Among workers more widely, however, a determination to halt and throw back the detested invaders was probably the greatest motivator that drove productivity. The Soviets also achieved impressive economies of scale, restricting their production to a small number of weapon types in a small number of giant factories. The most famous Soviet production story was the remarkably successful T-34 tank. It still suffered numerous design problems, particularly the layout of its turret, the quality of its gun sights, and its initial lack of a radio. However, so massive was the investment required to build one of the colossal KV-1s that the Soviets recognized that T-34s should be a future priority for mass production. On the German side, in January 1942, Hitler issued an order to reorganize the arms industry, with top priority going to field weapons, followed by mechanized forces and anti-tank guns. But the arrival of quality new weaponry, such as the MG-42 machine gun, could not fully compensate for the shortfall in production figures. The new 50mm anti-tank gun was supposed to replace the German infantry's 37mm anti-tank gun, but there were few of these as yet. The shortfall among the panzer divisions following their evisceration of 1941 was particularly difficult to make up. For instance, by June 1942, the German army claimed a total strength of around 5,300 panzers, slightly higher than the figure of a year previously, but around 2,000 were obsolescent. The Panzer Division's main workhorse in 1942 was the Mark III, but it could not match the T-34 tank for tank. Nevertheless, Mark III and Mark IV medium panzers could at least narrow the gap with the T-34 when installed with, respectively, new 5cm and 7.5cm guns, even though the new long-barreled 75mm Mark IV had yet to be produced in significant numbers by the time Army Group South took the offensive. The Germans also put obsolete panzers to good use, for a captured Soviet gun mounted on an obsolete panzer chassis made for a useful, if less manoeuvrable, type of vehicle, the tank destroyer. Thus was born the first generation of tank destroyers, Panzerjäger, the Marders. Also in for an overhaul was military intelligence. General Halder excoriated the FHO for its performance in 1941, dismissing its assessments as in crass contrast to my own. He sacked Colonel Kinzel in March 1942, replacing him with Colonel Reinhard Gehlen, who, in Halder's view, combined excellent technical professional ability, remarkable industriousness, strong creative force, and soldierly drive. Gehlen was not quite the intelligence genius he liked to style himself as. He sometimes made vague prognostications that were broadly wrong, but then subsequently fixed on the isolated correct points he had made to suggest he had been broadly right. But he certainly improved the FHO's performance. He brought in new blood to enlarge it, pensioned off some of the old lags, systematized training, established larger and more specialized subsections, introduced a comprehensive card system for information storage and retrieval, and liaised effectively with the similarly revamped intelligence office of the Luftwaffe in the East, Fremde Luftwaffe Ost, FLO. Gehlen also ensured that the FHO's daily reports became more detailed. They now included reports not just on the enemy's dispositions, but also on his likely intentions. The FHO based its reports on the systematic evaluation of all enemy communication means, including press and radio, aerial reconnaissance, frontline reconnaissance, interrogating POWs, and evaluating captured papers. Intelligence gathering at the front itself became more effective. In particular, because of the obstacles to aerial reconnaissance, the Germans placed new stress on prisoner interrogations. Frontline intelligence also learned new tricks. For instance, a good indicator of whether a Soviet attack was imminent was when alcohol was distributed to Red Army troops. While Army Group South geared up for Operation Blue, the German front's northern and central sectors remained in a state of static defense. "It's incredibly monotonous and boring here," wrote Wachtmeister Josef L. of the 129th Infantry Division from the central sector in August 1942. "While in the south, German armies are marching, pushing the Russians back and notching up success after success on their banners, we are holding the front. This inactivity is slowly reducing me to a state of mindlessness." Stripped of most of their mechanized transport and weaponry to feed the southern offensive, the troops also slid further into those pre-modernized conditions that recall the Western Front during the First World War. Panzer troops found their new status particularly galling. "Today," wrote Lance Corporal Werner F. of the 12th Panzer Division at the beginning of July 1942, "the Wehrmacht report announced that German and Allied troops are on the offensive. Everywhere is rolling forward except in this wretched north. This eternal lying about is no fun at all, and prompts our superiors to come up with all means of keeping us occupied, including the thing I hate most in the army, parades." The mood was even more surly on the swampy, heavily forested Volkhov front in Army Group North's area, which the 121st Infantry Division's commander described as the world's asshole. The priority accorded Operation Blue also banished the northern and central armies to the back of the supply queue. "The food has gone to shit lately," wrote Lance Corporal Ferdinand M. of the 167th Infantry Division in July 1942. "Fortunately, there is fruit and veg to buy, but when I next show father how large our meat ration is, he'll need to put on his spectacles. Horses as well as men suffered. The cold, wet weather has reduced the horses to skeletons again, wrote Wachtmeister Arthur W. of the 129th Infantry Division in October. Yesterday one fell in front of his cart and was dead. Another one went today. When it gets cold again, the great death will really begin. Both sectors were also at the back of the replacement queue. The new replacements, all from older age groups who've arrived here, are just a joke, wrote Josef L. on 10 September. These are people who supposedly would rather be soldiers than workers, but they just shiver and feel ill all the time. One has a stomach problem, another can't see anything in the dark, and all try to pull a fast one of some kind or other. Yet despite initial appearances, the northern and central sectors were not monotonous backwaters during 1942. For most of the year, half the Germans' field armies in the east were stationed there, and during the second half of 1942 they faced and repelled a succession of local Red Army offensives. Soviet offensive tactics were undergoing a slow, painful evolution from the previous year. Moreover, because the German onslaught in the south compelled the Soviets to commit more forces there than to the center and north, the Red Army could often commit only second-rate troops to its central and northern offensives. Lieutenant Albert K. of the 3rd Mountain Division, serving in the north, experienced a three-day battle south of Lake Ladoga in early October, in which his division captured 6,000 Red Army soldiers, many of whom made an exhausted, undernourished impression. All the prisoners were old men and 16 to 17-year-olds. The 129th Infantry Division had similar experiences in the Rzhev sector further south. The Germans also repelled these offensives, despite their own often poor quality replacements, because their second order and stationary divisions were good at defensive warfare. Among other things, the relative quiet on the central and northern fronts for much of 1942 helped the Germans construct and fortify their positions properly. We are very happy, wrote Wachtmeister Arthur W. in November, to have strong bunkers and plenty of munitions. My bunker is quite cozy and warm, with moderate light, but the Russians provided plenty of firewood for us in August. Instructions issued by the 9th Army in January 1943 directed that the best trench lines include a connecting trench between them and be dug deep and thin, the better to protect their occupants from Soviet artillery. Such trenches were often also too thin for Soviet tanks even to notice them. In order to disorientate attacking Red Army troops further, small niche trenches just deep enough for men to fire out of peppered the landscape near the main trenches. The need to build well-constructed, well-fortified trenches was one of the things compelling units to cultivate a more constructive relationship with the civilian population. Quite simply, they could not do it without civilian labor. The 123rd Infantry Division, which fought in the Demyansk pocket in Army Group North's sector, used civilians to construct defensive positions and maintain the roads. In return for their continued help, it took greater care over the population's food supply once this became possible after links with the 16th Army outside the pocket were re-established. By the summer of 1942, much of the 123rd sector had become a veritable allotment, with the division cultivating vegetables including cabbage, turnips, and potatoes, and also setting up communal soup kitchens. This was a pragmatic policy, not a humanitarian one, for it was a means of keeping the population alive so that it could work for the Germans. Divisional command also pointed out, "It is important that we bring in 100% of the harvest so the troops are not responsible for feeding the civilian population this winter." In October, the OKH issued directions for building anti-tank trenches, not just to halt tanks, but also to trap them. Once the Germans had dug the trench, they piled the excavated earth high on their side of the trench to make a further obstacle. Another favorite anti-tank device was the hedgehog, a piece of cross-shaped angled iron. The Germans usually placed these behind the main fighting line so they were less vulnerable to enemy fire, but still able to prevent tanks from breaking through. The 25th Infantry Division believed it was able to withstand attack thanks to its high-quality artillery, together with timely assistance from neighboring divisions' artillery. The German infantry's 37mm and 50mm anti-tank guns could destroy Soviet armor only at close range, so the Germans learned to deploy them on reverse slopes. 88s could destroy Soviet armor at long range, but there were not enough of them, and they were highly visible from the air. To compensate, German infantry and engineers underwent exhaustive training for close combat tank engagements. The Germans also learned that rapid counterattacks at the base of the Soviet penetration, backed up where possible by Sturmgeschütze and Panzerjäger, were the best. If the enemy invaded their position at night, they were to counterattack rapidly before the enemy could orientate himself. It will be clear from all this that the Second Order and Stationary Divisions of Army Groups North and Center did not merely sit still throughout 1942. Fixed defenses, but also firepower and rapid counterattack, were intrinsic to the defensive doctrine the German army practiced. The army was able to prosecute such measures so effectively because it grounded them in older principles and experiences. The defensive warfare lessons it had imbibed during the First World War, the Truppenführung regulations that had entrenched those lessons further, and most fundamentally the flexibility, initiative, aggression, and coordination that were inimical to Auftragstaktik. Examples from the Army Group Center sector in 1942 demonstrate that even in defense, divisions with varying levels of combat power had the opportunity to show what they could do and make good at least some of their shortcomings. The 385th Infantry Division's manpower was substandard, mainly comprising men relatively advanced in years and drafted from industry. Of the 30 company commanders across its two infantry regiments, 21 were reservists. Most of the division's officers and NCOs lacked effective military training or experience. Yet thanks in large part to its energetic commander, Major General Karl Eibel, it acquitted itself well. The division generally fought within a small geographical area, and this enabled the commander to keep a tight rein on developments. He and his subordinates were regularly on the telephone, and he regularly visited the troops in the line. The 385th was not a purveyor of Auftragstaktik then, but it did its specific job well. The 10th Motorized Infantry Division had suffered heavy losses in officers and men since June 1941, and by 1942 was motorized only in name. But its active officers and men still outnumbered the reservists. Like the 385th, the 10th fought in a small area with effective telephone communications and a hands-on commander. But the 10th practiced Auftragstaktik more than the 385th because Major General August Schmidt did not merely give his subordinates orders, but also involved them in the planning process. The division also sent out regular combat patrols. These needed NCOs to show surprise, speed, and independent action if they were to be effective. A greater contrast with the 385th Infantry Division was the elite Grossdeutschland Infantry Division. This formation was regularly rushed to the danger points along the line in the way of a fire brigade, particularly when the Red Army was on the offensive. In the forefront of numerous large-scale counterattacks, the Grossdeutschland's officers had ample opportunity to show their decisive, aggressive side. From the autumn of 1941, the OKH steadily intensified the troops' ideological instruction. In July 1942, for instance, it commanded frontline units to select officers to foster the correct worldview among the troops. But when Major Freiherr von Lerzner visited the 3rd Panzer Army that summer, its intelligence section argued that officers should take an even more hands-on approach. It asserted that the troops faced greater pressure and danger in this war than had their forebears between 1914 and 1918, but also that a great opportunity lay in the fact that young officers had been schooled in Nazi thinking. The intelligence section particularly lauded the performance of a company commander course in Gschatzk, which included lectures on assessing the military-political situation, the war as a spiritual confrontation, and the front-line experience as a decisive moment of the true coming into being of the people, Volksverdung. The troops had also received lectures on the principles of the Russian campaign, the basis of the war against England, the battle for the Second Front, and the relationship between homeland and front. Soldiers everywhere want a clear picture of the situation and their connection to it, the intelligence section maintained. In particular, the divisions in Army Group Center need to know that their defense is playing an important role in the outcome of the war, just like the attacks by the armies in the south. The 3rd Panzer Army appointed a divisional pastoral officer to take over responsibility for the troops' spiritual care and propaganda. The officer in question was to liaise with the Army's personnel officer, visit the Army's larger formations, and keep in contact with unit commanders. Unit commanders themselves were to distribute Mitteilungen für die Truppe, communications for the troops, and Mitteilungen für das Offizierkorps, communications for the officer corps. The 3rd Panzer Army would also distribute a regular newsletter and a monthly publication, Erziehung und Bildung, Education and Training. The 9th Army, stationed on the then quiet Rzhev sector of the front, concurred with the 3rd Panzer Army and introduced similar measures, proclaiming that the spiritual and mental leadership of our men is of decisive importance in maintaining our moral ability to endure. Though the Soviet offensives of the latter months of 1942 in the north and centre all failed, they did tie down forces that the Germans might otherwise have committed to the south. Army Group South's new commander was the reactivated Field Marshal von Bock, who replaced Field Marshal von Reichenau after the latter's remarkably short tenure as an Army Group commander. Reichenau, an inveterate fitness fanatic, had dropped dead in January following an ill-advised cross-country run in sub-zero temperatures. Before Operation Blue Proper began, Army Group South fought 2 preliminary battles. These showed that, however reduced its potency, the German Army's offensive performance could still outshine the Red Army's. The first operation was to clear the Crimea of Soviet troops, a job the German Army had only half finished in 1941. Finishing it would assure the Germans of a secure right flank as they advanced into the Caucasus and would prevent the VVS from posing any threat to Romania's oil fields. The task fell to Colonel General von Manstein's 11th Army. Manstein enjoyed 2 advantages over the Red Army forces in the Crimea. Firstly, the OKH had made clearing the Crimea a priority for the Luftwaffe, so he could count on massive air support. Secondly, much of the Red Army's strength on the peninsula was exposed in a salient. Manstein destroyed the forces in the salient at the Battle of Kerch. Nevertheless, his delay in taking the port of Sevastopol, partly caused by his own mistake in dispersing his forces too widely, and partly by the lack of a concurrent naval and air blockade, held up the start of Operation Blue. Blue was delayed further by the second battle the Germans had to fight against the Red Army offensive that Marshal Timoshenko launched in the Kharkov sector on 12 May. At this stage, Stalin still often spurned cautionary advice from his generals, but Timoshenko did persuade him that if he must attack, then Kharkov was the best place to do it. Timoshenko's attack made good progress at first and received further armored reinforcements. But during the lull between the Battle of Kerch and Manstein's final assault on Sevastopol, Bock received powerful army and Luftwaffe reinforcements from the Crimea. He employed German defensive tactics on the grand operational scale, unleashing the 1st Panzer Army, Kleist's renamed Panzer Group 1, and the 17th Army to cut the Soviet advance at Kharkov in the rear at its narrowest point, then trap it in a pocket to devastating effect. The Red Army's defeats in Kharkov and the Crimea cost it 3 armies destroyed and a further 3 weakened. But because of all this, Operation Blue itself did not commence until 28 June. The frontline armies of Army Group South comprised the 2nd, 6th and 17th Armies, the 1st and 4th Panzer Armies, a motorized corps, and the Hungarian 2nd Army. Their operation was to unfold in 4 phases. During the first, the Germans would encircle and destroy Soviet forces around Voronezh, then create a roof between Voronezh and Orel to protect the advancing German army's flank and rear. During Phase 2, the Germans would encircle Soviet forces further south on the central part of the River Don, with a drive east of Kharkov meeting a simultaneous German advance from the north. During the third phase, the Germans would thrust up and down the River Don to encircle and destroy Soviet forces in the Don Bend, northwest of the major industrial city of Stalingrad. They would also reach the River Volga and Stalingrad itself. Finally, the Germans would drive south into the Caucasus. Soviet intelligence failed to anticipate Operation Blue. The Red Army was trying to assemble a new strategic echelon and reserve during the summer of 1942, but Army Group South struck before these were ready. The Germans hit the first echelons of the southwestern and southern fronts hard, and the Red Army now had to assemble new defense lines along the Voronezh, Stalingrad, and Caucasus axes. The key line was along the Don and Volga rivers deep into the Caucasus. Along this, the Red Army deployed no fewer than 6 fronts. Yet Hitler and the OKH were seeking less to carry out grand encirclements on the 1941 scale than to proceed slowly and methodically against a sequence of smaller objectives. Hitler was not being uncharacteristically modest, but acknowledging the constraints the German army now needed to work within. For a start, Army Group South was uncomfortably short of armor. It was supposed to have received 1,900 panzers and assault guns, but received only 1,700, of which 300 were command tanks or obsolescent Mark II models. The Luftwaffe, meanwhile, could only spare 1,500 of its 2,700 available aircraft in the east. Attacking smaller objectives, then, would create pockets with outer rims of a size that Army Group South's limited armor could actually hold, and targets that would enable the Luftwaffe to concentrate its own limited resources more effectively. Hitler and the OKH also wanted to avoid overburdening the new recruits. The closely controlled command structure that Hitler and Halder had now implemented would enable them to keep a tight rein on operations. That said, senior commanders like Field Marshal von Bock and General Hutt, now in charge of the 4th Panzer Army, resented being straitjacketed in this way. Army Group B and the 6th Army captured their assigned objectives, encircling and destroying most of the Soviet 21st and 40th Armies and reaching the long western bank of the River Don within 15 days. Yet cracks were already appearing. In capturing Voronezh, Bock believed he had secured an objective that would help strengthen Blue's rear and flank. Hitler, however, considered Voronezh an expensive diversion. He accused Bock of spending too long capturing the city and allowing Soviet forces elsewhere to escape. Hitler then saw that Soviet forces might escape the Donbass region, and this time ordered Bock to hold up the advance on Stalingrad so that panzers could be diverted to the lower River Don and Rostov to destroy Soviet forces there. When Bock objected, Hitler replaced him with the more pliable General von Weichs and gave him the same order. In the event, a third of the Soviet forces on the lower Don managed to escape, and the Germans missed their best opportunity to take Stalingrad. This was when the Germans' problems really started. 2 weeks after Hitler fired Field Marshal von Bock, this time for good, he announced a new plan to make good the delays. The original plan for Operation Blue saw Army Group South completing its later phases successively. But now it was to complete them all at once, and divide into 2 army groups for the purpose. Army Group A, under Field Marshal List, comprising the 11th and 17th Armies and the 1st and 4th Panzer Armies, would complete the drive on the Caucasus. Army Group B, under General von Weichs, comprised the 2nd and 6th Armies and the Hungarian 2nd Army. It was to reach the Volga, take Stalingrad, and thereby secure Army Group A's northern flank. While Blue might just have made good its mechanized and manpower limitations, it now strained under an excess of simultaneous objectives. Hitler, however, again saw only a broken Red Army, and believed the Soviets were finished. In his own mind, then, increasing Blue's range of operational targets seemed eminently reasonable. The Germans killed far fewer surrendering Red Army soldiers in Operation Blue than they had in 1941. Partly this was because commanders had learned how to rein in their men more effectively. In particular, at the start of 1942, senior commanders had prevailed upon Hitler to rescind the Commissar Order. Though they had widely accepted and implemented it in 1941, they now recognized that its main effect had been to harden Red Army resistance. But a bigger reason why the Germans killed far fewer surrendering Red Army soldiers in Operation Blue was that they progressed too haltingly to encircle all that many Soviet troops in the first place. The less-than-lightning pace of the German advance was attested to by the war diary of the 4th Mountain Division on 26 July. As many divisions come together, log jams are created on the roads, and the animals are brought to a standstill. Men and animals are exhausted after having to march days without shade in the blazing sun. The number of heat stroke cases is increasing. Furthermore, Red Army units did not always obligingly stand, fight, and perish as they had in 1941. Instead, they often made prudent, timely withdrawals, or perhaps more accurately, fled in panic. This was certainly how Lieutenant Helmut D. of the 4th Mountain Division perceived it in a letter of early August. In particular, he noted that the Soviets were no longer bothering to carry out scorched earth measures. Oddly, the Russian has left behind nearly all his poultry, livestock, vegetables, and so on. A year ago, it was completely different. Nor has he destroyed his railway lines like he did before. Where this is coming from, I don't know. Does he have too few men to destroy everything? And as the Germans advanced further east, without encircling and destroying large Red Army formations, their supply lines were stretched ever more precariously. On 6 August, wrote Lance Corporal Franz B. of the 198th Infantry Division, we took down our tents and the advance continued, over 80 kilometers, 50 miles, through the steppe. Now we know what real steppe looks like. A blazing heat, the roads full of dust. This is the journey of the horse-drawn columns, the artillery, ever onwards into the endless wilderness of the Russian Empire. The infantry, of course, have it worst of all. Stalin, at last acknowledging his limitations as a military commander, heeded his new deputy supreme commander, Marshal Georgi Zhukov, when the latter cautioned against launching a major counteroffensive too soon. Zhukov believed that drawing the Germans on further, building reinforcements and waiting to counterattack in the winter, was a surer route to success. General Alexander Vasilevsky, chief of the General Staff from June 1942, similarly reined in Stalin's more ambitious thinking and persuaded him to listen to his generals more. Yet the Red Army was not simply slipping away to bide its time before launching a counteroffensive. Along many parts of the line, it resisted tenaciously and launched ferocious small-scale counterattacks. The main reason why more Red Army formations were escaping destruction was not because they were fleeing without a fight, but because the Germans were no longer strong enough to encircle and destroy them. Moreover, despite the improvements the FHO had made to its operation, the Germans still underestimated the Soviets' ability to generate new formations or replace old ones. In the course of August alone, Army Groups A and B between them suffered 200,000 casualties. The particularly strung-out advance on Stalingrad was alarmingly exposed from the off. Paulus, now a general of panzer troops and the 6th Army's commander, commented on the danger to his senior adjutant, Colonel Adam. Should the Russians take advantage of the weakness in our deep flank, we will be in a more than unpleasant situation, Adam. Look at how the front runs. It is like a clenched fist. Really devilishly unpleasant, General. The enemy only now needs to apply the scalpel to the wrist, and the fist is off. Although it would be months before Stalin and the Red Army leadership executed their counterstrike, they had already taken note of the opportunity that the 6th Army's advance was gifting them. On reaching the Caucasus, Field Marshal List's Army Group A initially made heady progress. At this stage in the campaign, it also commanded the biggest share of Blue's armor, transportation, and fuel supplies. The 198th Infantry Division under the 1st Panzer Army advanced through the increasingly mountainous terrain of the western Caucasus. "We're right among the mountains now," wrote Private Christian B. on 23 August. "They're certainly steep, but not terribly high yet. But as we advance further in this sector, we'll rarely come up against the mountain ranges proper. Here there are lots of snipers, for the Russians can hide themselves very well in this brushwood, and it's very difficult for our infantry to comb these forests." General Eberhard von Mackensen's 3 Panzer Corps was in the forefront of the advance. On 10 August, his forces captured Maikop, and although the Red Army had destroyed the city's oil facilities, German engineers soon had them working again. But in early August, Army Group A was denied the assistance of Manstein's 11th Army, once earmarked to cross from the Crimea into the Caucasus, but now dispatched to the Leningrad front. Around the same time, the 4th Panzer Army and much of Army Group A's air support was switched to Army Group B's drive on Stalingrad and the Volga. Halder and the OKH believed the country here was far better for rapid armored movement than the Caucasus, and that these forces were needed to bolster Army Group B's flagging advance. In doing so, they flipped the Germans' operational objectives around. Now it was Stalingrad and the Volga, not the Caucasus, that were the top priority. By late August, Army Group A's advance had perceptibly slowed. Hitler nevertheless drove on Army Group A's depleted forces. When the 1st Mountain Division diverted troops from its advance to plant the German flag on Mount Elbrus, the highest peak in the Caucasus,